All right, let's do it. Final speaker of the afternoon is Chris Meek, who comes to us from the University of Western Ontario. Professor Smink will be speaking to us on cosmological laws without real time.
Okay, so let me adjust the microphone first because she's with an illness, and the other organizers from the Boston University Center for Philosophy of Science for Randy McLaughlin. So please join me in thanking them. And I can add on a personal note that it's a real pleasure to have been invited. It was terrific to have an opportunity to look at this provocative and stimulating work by Lee and Roberta. And this talk represents my attempt to come to grips with some of these ideas from a slightly different angle than what they're pursuing. And that was meant to be reflected in the title. So I think there are some very basic questions in cosmology that face cosmology in a way that sets it apart from other areas of physics. One is just what kind of science is cosmology? What is the kind of inquiry that is being pursued in cosmology, and how does it compare to other aspects of physics? So is cosmology more of a historical science like other areas of science, as opposed to law-seeking, where we usually think of physics is seeking laws that state fundamental relationships between quantities? Cosmology seems to be involved perhaps in doing that along with constructing a history of the universe, or perhaps more on the side of developing a historical account of the universe. So associated with that question about the nature and aim of cosmology, there's, the nature of cosmology is there's a question of what the appropriate explanatory aims for cosmology are. Should we be seeking to answer the kinds of questions that physicists have answered in other fields in developing a cosmological theory? And so I think of Lee and Roberto as providing really provocative answers to both of these questions based on a few really substantially new proposals. One is that these questions are both intricately connected to the nature of time. And there's then the proposal about real time, and I'll be talking about my understanding of that in a moment. But really, I think it sets an agenda for cosmology. As Lee said this morning, he thinks that some of the problems, the meta-laws dilemma, will be something that's on the agenda for 21st century cosmology. So I'm going to call this at some point later on the Leibnizian approach, partly because of the overall scope of explanatory questions that are being pursued, and I think Lee is very clear in his book, at least, about his intellectual debt to Leibniz and some of the principles that motivate these explanatory aims. So, in outline, the first part of my talk is going to be a kind of poor man versions of Janann's talk, actually, so I'll probably go through this fairly quickly. And then I'll come to a discussion of the nature of aims of cosmology, and then say something briefly about evolving laws. So all of these issues are things that arose in looking at Lee and Roberto's work, and so these are really reflections from a different point of view on these same questions that we've been hearing about throughout the session this afternoon. So first let me say briefly a few things about what we could think of as the manifest image of time. Time as we experience it has several properties. I've listed here four. I don't mean this to be an exclusive or comprehensive list, but these are the sort of things that have been focused on by natural philosophers from Aristotle forward, features of time that are quite prominent in our experience of it. The first, you can think of various processes that you undergo in everyday life, such as waiting in line for a cup of coffee as having a duration, and you soon discover that some of those processes will have actually fixed periods or something close to that, and you can think of them measuring durations or intervals of time. I think it's fairly obvious to extrapolate from that sort of experience to think of those intervals and durations as parts of all time or an entire continuum of time, and also to think then of dividing points between intervals as points of time without themselves having any duration. It's also natural to think that there's a temporal ordering of precedence of those points, and that this will be absolute in the sense that it will be independent of the state of motion of different observers. Again, this is something that we will see becomes a question later on. And then there's the other features that we've already discussed earlier today, the clear separation into different tenses the openness of the future as opposed to the current status of the present, the ever-moving presence, and the fixity of the past, and finally, the sense of flow or passage. So these are sort of obvious features of our experience of time. And in contrast, I think there's a very different set of claims that are involved in the scientific image of time. And I think that these are ultimately motivated by what is needed to underwrite a particular scientific theory. And so we'll talk briefly about classical physics and relativistic physics, in which different aspects of time are needed to undergird the descriptions that that theory offers of physical systems. Now, it turns out that in any of the physical theories that I'm going to be discussing, in all of the theories I'm going to be discussing, there are aspects of the manifest image that are apparently not needed for physics. And then there's a further question of what to say about those aspects of the manifest image. And this is related to the question of trying to reconcile a kind of manifest and scientific image. It goes back to Eddington's example of the two tables. This is a similar question. One thing I should say, I think it's clear that one feature of the manifest image should be that we wouldn't necessarily take our commitments to features of the manifest image as being too fixed or too determinate, in the sense that in a lot of cases our manifest image turns out to be approximate and vague in ways that are understandable as a result of our physiology and the way our brains work. And so I don't think, when I say that we can reconcile these, I don't mean to be saying that we should be having equal commitment to the features of the manifest image of time. We might end up realizing that those are things that we should reject. So in Newtonian times, this is the famous scolium from the Principia. I think Newton very clearly, in the scolium to the definitions, where he famously discusses space and time, is concerned with elucidating what structures are needed for space and time in order to do two things. One is to draw the crucial distinction between inertial and accelerated motion. So for him, he argued that the relational definitions of motion that were then in vogue were not sufficient for drawing this distinction. Instead, you had to introduce a structure which would allow you to distinguish between, in effect, a straight line through space and time. An inertial motion is one in which a body moves on a straight line with uniform velocity, and a departure from that is a curved motion through space and time. And also, he needed to have enough space and time structure to introduce quantities that appear in the force laws. So, obviously, for gravitation, the force of gravitation depends upon the instantaneous distance between two bodies. So you needed to have that be a well-defined quantity, so you needed to have sufficient spatial and temporal structure to define that quantity. So this is all fairly familiar territory, I'm guessing, but in the context then of determining what in fact is necessary for those two goals, Newton introduces a structure composed of spatial geometries at an instant. You can think of these as a stack of three-dimensional surfaces that each have a Euclidean geometry, and then they're stacked in a one-dimensional order, which reflects a time dimension. Now, of course, to define motion, you also need a kind of rigging connecting those elements of the stack. So you need an affine connection that will define a straight line through that stack of elements. So in this picture, then, we have time as a one-dimensional space of a certain type. I've just denoted this with this funny T. There are other features that are important. That's the time interval between any two events is globally defined. Take any two events and I can tell you how much time elapsed between them, meaning you can find them in the stack, and the time interval is a measure of how far apart that those two slices are in the stack, in effect. And it's absolute, namely, the stack and the time interval between the elements of the stack doesn't shift when you look at observers in different states of motion. So this was the kind of structure that Newton introduced. I've been focusing on the nature of time in particular. This is the kind of structure that he introduced in order to be able to do the two things I mentioned on the previous slide, to draw a distinction between inertial and accelerated motion, and to define the quantities that appeared in the force laws of his theory. But if we go back to our manifest image of time, at most this the structure includes the first two aspects of the manifest image of time that I indicated. It doesn't say anything about flow, passage, tenses, anything of that sort. That's just not reflected in this structure. And I think it's clear that for Newton, these ended up not being essential for the kind of question he was posing and the inquiry he was pursuing. He was interested in understanding the causes of motions, primarily the planetary motions, but also other objects near the Earth's surface that were dominated by the gravitational force. In order to understand the causes of motions, he only needed to draw the distinctions that that I described earlier. So those other features of time were just not important for the kind of inquiry that he was pursuing. Now, I think this leads to a large question. When we ask, how should we reconcile the manifest and scientific image? And I think there are actually two different possibilities here. You might regard a particular account of time as just being indifferent to certain parts of the manifest image. So it might be the case that certain aspects of the common phenomenal experience of time that we have are not presupposed by or even relevant to a particular inquiry. So in that case, there would be no obstacle necessarily to reconciliation. It's just not a part of the time structure that will be needed for the inquiry that's being currently pursued. And I'm suggesting that that's the case for the notion of a now or a flow of time in the way Newton is describing the dynamical evolution of a system under the force of gravity, for example. There is also a possibility, though, that an aspect of the manifest image is decisively undermined or rendered odious. It's explained away rather than reconciled with the introduction of a new aspect of the scientific image. And I think to see this at work, we need to turn to relativity. There were various aspects of time that were that might have been widely accepted before Newton that were incompatible with his views. But I think the case is a bit clearer with relativity, and this is where a lot of more contemporary disputes have focused. So again, I'm assuming that this is at least somewhat familiar. In 1905, Einstein realized, in effect, that because of the invariant speed of light, it didn't have to be light, but the fact that there's an invariant speed that's enshrined in Maxwell's equations led to a challenge to the Newtonian conception of space and time. Rather than thinking of space and time intervals as being separate, the quantity that was invariant under transformations, including boosts to moving observers, was a combination of spatial distance and temporal intervals. That's the space-time interval. And one of the structures that is characteristic of the space-time characterized by that interval is the light cone shown at the left, which just reflects the fact that for a given observer, all observers will agree about the way that light travels from a point. If you imagine the vertex of the cone being a point of emission of a light beam, all observers will agree about how the light beam is emitted and the way that that's described in space and time. So again, like Newton, we can see Einstein is posing questions about space and time now, reflecting on the physics of his day, which includes Maxwell's equations, and we have a different set of structures that are needed to undergird the physics that was at hand for Einstein. So rather than having space and time intervals separately, we need an invariant space-time interval. And similarly, rather than having instantaneous distance at a time in the force law for gravity, we have field equations which are specified in terms of local interactions, and those can be written in terms of the geometry of Minkowski space-time. And Minkowski famously declared in his 1908 lecture, henceforth, space by itself and time by itself are doomed to fade away into mere shadows, and only a kind of the union of the two will preserve an independent reality. So based on this introduction of Minkowski space-time, it's tempting to run a kind of eliminativist argument. I'm mentioning two aspects of this. So I think there is a powerful eliminativist argument against thinking of spatial distance and temporal distance separately as having a well-defined physical meaning. So I think it's clear that if you accept the move leads to Minkowski spacetime, it's no longer possible to think of spatial distance simpliciter as if it has a well-defined meaning. There's a destructive aspect to Einstein's argument that shows there were presuppositions that led you to think you could measure instantaneous three-dimensional distance that are undermined in the physics of his day. So this is a case where I think we should clearly explain away the features of the manifest image. We thought we could measure spatial distances in a way that was just measuring three-dimensional spatial distance at an instant, but in fact, we neglected the finite speed of light. And it's only because the speed of light is so much greater than the sort of ordinary distances and times we're used to working with that we neglected to notice this until we had a great deal more precision than most of us experience in everyday life. So I think this is a clear sense in which you can argue that the manifest image might include a separation between spatial distance and temporal intervals, but that that's undermined by the advent of special relativity, that you can see that as something that reflects our limitations in the way we experience space and time. Now there's a second type of eliminativist argument, and Lee referred to this earlier. Is it also the case that because special relativity does not include a notion of passage, and yet it includes a notion of relative simultaneity, is it the case that that you're forced to accept something like a block universe picture, or an internalist picture in which the universe is and somehow all existing at one time? I think in this case, the eliminativist argument is much more problematic. And let me explain briefly why. So imagine that we try to introduce a relation, which we take to be a relation between events, which we define as real with respect to, or definite with respect to. So this would be a relation which will take two events as its inputs, and it will say, given an event like this one, and I want to ask what's real or determinate with respect to that event. And I make certain assumptions about this relation. Putnam and various others have argued that it's a fairly straightforward consequence of special relativity in the geometry of Minkowski spacetime that, given the assumptions about this relation, the only relation that will satisfy those assumptions and be compatible with the spacetime structure of Minkowski spacetime is a trivial relation, namely that all events are real with respect to each other. And that's the argument that then is meant to motivate the block universe picture. Now, I think that argument is too quick in the following sense. I think that you can have a different kind of relation. So the argument, by the way, really just depends upon thinking of real with respect to is something like absolute simultaneity in the Newtonian picture. Right? And it turns out that there isn't a well-defined notion of absolute simultaneity in special relativity. We already knew that, but Putnam's sort of trying to force a relation of real with respect to look like simultaneity, and it turns out that you can't have one. Again, no surprise, given that we've been forced to adopt relativity of simultaneity. But if you take a slightly different relation, which you can think of as already definite or having become, so think of now not defining a set of points that are present with respect to a given event, but ones that are definite now with respect to a given event, or ones that are in the past with respect to a given event. You can take the past light cone of a point as giving the domain of points that falls under that definition. And Howard Stein argued in a few papers that this is a perfectly, this relation, unlike the Putnam relation, doesn't reduce to a trivial relation. It's compatible with the basic structure of Minkowski spacetime. It does have a quite counterintuitive aspect, namely that it's relative to the particular event you're talking about. So it's sometimes called here-nowism, as a kind of, I think, derogatory term. And so there's philosophers who've been interested in trying to give an account of passage who are not satisfied with that description or with that relation. I find it hard to give an argument against that relation as a reasonable way of incorporating a sense of becoming in Minkowski spacetime that doesn't just end up recapitulating intuitions about absolute simultaneity. Right, so I think it's hard to give an argument that doesn't just end up being based upon intuitions that you should have already abandoned given the shift to Minkowski spacetime. So as I said, this is still something that's quite controversial if he has different people who work in this area, some of them would say Stein's relation is no real notion of becoming. It's unsatisfying for various reasons. But I think it's an example of how difficult the eliminativist argument can be. And I don't think that this is a clear-cut elimination of passage or becoming in special relativity. So now I come back to, this is where I overlap most closely with Chan-An. We were both struck by the Carnap quote, and we both agree that, against Lee, that there seems to be a way in which Carnap could be right here. So again, Carnap is saying contra Einstein in this conversation they're having, that perhaps aspects of man's experience related to time, namely the manifest image of time, can be described and explained in psychology, even though they are apparently not included in physics. So I'm just emphasizing here that the aspects of the manifest image not needed in current physics doesn't mean that they might not be needed later. So it's first of all possible that physics would come to discover that an adequate physical theory has to introduce more structure than has currently been introduced. Right? So that's always a possibility. It's a live possibility. And it could be introduced in other domains as well. So there might be ways in which aspects of time that just haven't been necessary for the kind of inquiry that physicists have been pursuing will become introduced in other fields. So I think Chan-An's account was a much richer description of how to understand the phenomenology of time from within cognitive science. Here I'm just gesturing to the possibility that in other fields of science you might actually introduce other kinds of structure in time, and if they're not incompatible with the underlying physics notion or could be treated as approximately accurate within a given domain, I think there'd be no objection. It is clear that I think various conceptions in physics do lead to a reformed conception of time, but it doesn't mean eliminating it entirely as an illusion. So this is why I said earlier that I think our manifest image, we shouldn't take it as being overly committal or overly precise. And so I think we can often see physics as forcing us to reform our notions of time, that it might have seemed to make sense to ask, you know, for somebody in Singapore, when did that occur? But in fact, if we're talking about events that are far enough away, it will not be the case that there's a definite notion there. It's just an extrapolation from my experience that usually for the events that I am aware of, it's easy to assign a common simultaneity, a sort of common time to events in ordinary experience. But we can reform that conception without necessarily eliminating all of the aspects of the manifest image as an illusion. So Lee gives a number of eliminativist arguments in his book. I think that's my label and not his. 9 different arguments that have been given in favor of the timeless view or a block universe view. And he argues that there's one common agreement. So I think I've covered maybe 3 of these. There's arguments from classical physics, from special relativity, from general relativity, from quantum cosmology. So I've only given a small sample here. But as referred earlier, there's one common ingredient he sees in these problematic arguments. And that's the Newtonian paradigm, as he calls it. This is a paradigm which is used in describing dynamical theories which are applicable to subsystems of the universe. And this is just sort of giving a summary of Lee's characterization of this paradigm. In that paradigm, there's a clear operational contrast between laws and initial conditions. You can vary the initial conditions of the systems you're dealing with, and the laws are meant to be regularities that are invariant across those, the dynamical laws characterizing the type of system you're interacting with. And finally, time is treated as an external parameter, according to this view. I actually think there's a way, I disagree with this last point, but I think for purposes of time, I'm not going to go into that at the moment. And I emphasize the connection with the Newtonian paradigm, because as we've seen, this is the paradigm that its applicability is being questioned in the context of cosmology. And so, again, this is characterizing Lee's project and Roberto's project This is the formulation Lee gives it in his book. What are the aims for cosmology going forward? The first two are just, well, we should preserve existing success, so we should be as conservative as possible. Scientific hypotheses should imply specific testable predictions. And there are two other things, and this is why I characterize this as a Leibnizian program in cosmology. Lee emphasizes, and Roberto has just emphasized, that these are important explanatory targets for a reformed science of cosmology, that the explanatory project of cosmology should be enlarged to include discussions of these two questions. Now, so I think of this as a contrast between two different approaches to cosmology. What I'll call Newtonian cosmology, given the terminology of the Newtonian paradigm, in which you think primarily of taking locally discovered dynamical laws and extrapolating them to describe the universe as a whole. This is essentially what's been done in 20th century cosmology, in describing the expanding universe models that are supported by the variety of evidence in their favor. Those are particular solutions of general relativity, which was a locally discovered theory which then you take to describe the universe as a whole. Similarly, in describing the constituents of the expanding universe, you use locally discovered particle nuclear physics and then particle physics in order to describe different episodes in the universe's evolution. Now, this is this kind of local to global extrapolation is what Lee and Roberto characterize as the cosmological fallacy, namely that it involves applying physical laws relevant to subsystems to the universe as a whole. I'll get back to my response to the fallacy in just a moment. And by contrast, a Leibnizian approach to cosmology is based on a variety of principles which are related to the explanatory aims of answering questions such as why these laws or why these initial conditions. And we've heard about some of these earlier today, so again, I can be brief. The principle of sufficient reason is meant to motivate the quest for an answer, the sort of rationalist idea that we do need to be able to explain why certain laws or certain initial conditions obtain. The principle of explanatory closure, which is that we shouldn't have something outside the universe involved in giving causal explanations of events within the universe, and so on. And there are various other principles that Lee introduces, but these are just three that have a familiar Leibnizian ring, which is why I've labeled this as a Leibnizian approach to cosmology. Now, I want to actually defend the Newtonian cosmology and ask in what sense this is really a fallacy. So clearly, the standard model of cosmology is primarily based on extrapolation of existing local physical laws to the domain of cosmology. And so clearly, this is an extrapolation that goes far beyond their empirically tested domains. And so you might be surprised that it works out so well, but in fact, it does. It actually ends up giving us a quite coherent account of the evolution of the universe. Now, one thing that is one qualm I have about identifying this as a fallacy is something that John actually raised earlier. There are some theories in which it would be clear that you need a subsystem-system distinction in order to derive a description of the evolution of the subsystem. Now, that's not the case in general relativity. You can describe a general relativistic model in which you don't treat it as a subsystem of anything else. So it's not clear that in general relativity, at least, there's a subsystem problem of the same sort as perhaps on certain interpretations of quantum mechanics you might run into. On certain interpretations of quantum mechanics, it might seem essential to have a distinction between a subsystem which is described quantum mechanically and some external observer. In that kind of context, you would have a problem with using that theory to describe the entire universe. But it's not clear that that actually applies to the general relativity and the other constituents of the standard model. So, so I do think that there's a distinction, though, between two different ways you can arrive at cosmological laws. One is to take the local dynamical laws and just extrapolate them madly and imagine that they cover the universe as a whole. And a second is to formulate laws that are, on the face of it, global. So One of the examples of this is Penrose's vital curvature hypothesis. This is a hypothesis about a constraint that would be placed on the initial state of the universe that you can't think of as other than a global constraint on a specific property, namely the behavior of the vial tensor as you approach a singularity. And so that kind of law, it is the case that you would have to think of it as formulated globally. So the point I'm emphasizing here is that it's these first kind of laws and the extrapolations that from local to global laws in this sense that have been the real foundation of the success of the standard model of cosmology. Now, I think the motivation for thinking there's a fallacy here derives from the uniqueness of the universe. And so the argument is that because the universe is unique, we can't operationalize the distinction between laws and initial conditions as we do for subsystems of the universe. And I think this overlooks a way in which laws can be tested, which don't require having multiple systems or an ensemble of observations of similar systems. And that's namely that you can test laws via successive approximations, where you're giving more and more detailed descriptions of one and the same system. In fact, this is how the Newtonian description of the solar system was developed. And the fact that you could give more and more detailed descriptions of the solar system without invoking something other than the gravitational force law was part of the success of Newton's system. And it's clear that that didn't require reasoning about other solar systems. You can think of it as reasoning that's built on a series of successive approximations to a single system. So this leads me to pose the following worry. Namely, I am in agreement with many of Lee and Roberto's criticisms of some of the prevailing trends in cosmology, eternal inflation, and multiverse ideas. I think there's a lot of important methodological issues they've raised. But I wonder if it's really a matter of principle and methodology, or a matter of a contingent feature of our universe, namely that the energy scales in the very early universe are much higher than what will ever be accessible to us via other means. So it seems to me that there might be an issue here that's more an issue of accessibility of relevant physics, that here we have a case where we only have sort of one evidential route to a particular kind of law, and that raises methodological problems. They might not be problems that are due to the Newtonian paradigm and its limits per se, as opposed to the problems that are associated with accessibility of distant domains. So as I said, I think the contrast here is quite stark, that there's a number of ways in which the approach I've described in the standard model are taken to be explanatorily insufficient. I agree that if you take this Newtonian approach, as I'm calling it, that you don't really have an answer to a why these laws or why these apparently improbable initial conditions kind of questions. But as somebody with empiricist rather than rationalist leanings, I'm tempted at some point to wonder whether we should regard these as explanatory stopping points. Now, this can seem too strong. It might imply a kind of quietistic attitude that we should just stop doing physics because we no longer seek more unified theories, or that we stop with a sense of satisfaction too early. That's not what I'm arguing. It's rather that in a system of physics, there might be some things that are really just things that you should take as the deepest level of explanation on offer. And in this case, it seems that laws and initial conditions are both candidates for being these sort of base-level brute facts that can be used to explain other things. So now, on the Leibnizian approach, that's not satisfying. So we should explain, and here I'm going to shift now to discussion of evolving laws. I think one of the promises of shifting to an account where laws can evolve and be treated as perhaps intermixed with initial conditions is that we can then explain them as the products of evolution. And Lee also argues in favor of the notion of real time that would give us a globally well-defined present moment. Let me say something briefly now in the closing section of the talk about this conception. So I've tried to formulate a definition of what we might mean by evolving laws, which you two can tell me whether it captures anything accurately about your conception or not. The idea that I formulated is simply that the laws would fail to be time translation invariant. That if you imagine having a model and shifting it around, that because the laws are evolving, the model won't be a solution of the laws at some other time. And so that's what this definition is meant to characterize. And you could say that it only holds for some small interval of time after which the laws are stable and no longer evolve. But this would be a way of trying to characterize evolution. One aspect of this that's crucial, of course, is that it's evolution with respect to some time parameter. So I'm imagining here a kind of fixed foliation with respect to which the laws evolve and are failing to be invariant with respect to that foliation. And so we need then a notion of a real time with respect to which we could define that evolution. Oh, and sorry, this is, before I get to that, there's a historical aside here that I thought might be interesting to bring up. This is something, evolving laws were something that actually motivated the steady state theorists. They were concerned about how you could actually have a scientific cosmology if the possibility of evolving laws was a live one. So they thought, well, perhaps the laws do change with respect to the constituents of the universe. Maybe the laws at an earlier era were different because the constituents of the universe were different. They actually argued in favor, their whole rationale for introducing what they called the perfect cosmological principle was to found a scientific cosmology. They said, if you have this possibility of evolving laws, you can't actually reason at all. You can't make any safe extrapolation to distant realms, so we're going to rule out any change over time whatsoever in order to combat this menace of evolving laws. So I mention this because it's a kind of ironic contrast of we now see evolving laws proposed as a way of getting a new understanding of the early universe that will be testable as opposed to the competing conceptions which are taken as not being testable. But in this earlier episode, it was exactly the shoe was on the other foot. Okay, so now let me say something about reintroducing global time. This is something that Lee mentioned this morning, and I'll defer any technical questions about this to Lee. There's a recent development in the study of general relativity which allows you to introduce a notion of a global time, this idea of shape dynamics, in which, as far as I understand it, the parameter then that would correspond to the global time parameter is a motion along a foliation which is described by constant mean curvature slices through the space-time. And so we could think then of evolution in the sense I defined earlier with respect to that global time parameter. Now, I want to emphasize something, and I think Lee was clear about this morning as well. If this is the notion of an evolving law and the notion of a global time that's introduced, there's really no hope of this being directly connected to the manifest image of time and the features of that that were so puzzling that we were worried about being eliminated. Because the notion of passage and the notion of a global present moment are defined globally, and they're not actually connected to the local physics that would be relevant for critters like us. So this is a notion of global time that would be relevant for understanding evolving laws, but wouldn't tie directly back into giving us an account of our own experience of passage. So I think here, rather than thinking of this as being motivated by the need to reintroduce now or flow in relation to our manifest image, we can see it as progressing in much the way that Newton did, that if we think that the evolving laws are part of a successful scientific hypothesis, we need to introduce the appropriate structure to undergird those laws. In this case, we need a global time parameter in order to talk about how laws are evolving with respect to that time parameter. So, now, and there are a number of other hypotheses that Lee describes as being motivated by real time, but I find it hard to connect these back in much the same way as this last point. I find it hard to connect these back to the kind of concerns about the manifest image that that at least I started with, and maybe that's not the appropriate starting point for the concerns about real time, but the it isn't the real time is going to be directly the real time of our manifest image. It's rather a conception of time that's introduced in order to undergird specific scientific hypotheses that require a different kind of temporal structure than other current physical theories. So finally, I want to pose a few questions about the very notion of evolving laws. So we've heard both Lee and Roberto describe the question of the meta-law dilemma, and I take it as being, in my sort of simplified way, just a question of, well, if you have another law that describes the evolution of the underlying law, then you're back to the same picture, that you have laws and initial conditions, you just have perhaps a larger space in which you're considering things, and you still have the Newtonian paradigm of work. So it's clear that for the evolving laws conception to really break out of the explanatory approach that they find so problematic, there can't just be a sequence of laws. Otherwise, it just seems like you used the honorific too early, perhaps. You took a regularity that was, in fact, something that was just something that depended on a time parameter. There's another regularity lying behind that, which you should have been calling the law. That wouldn't be satisfying. That would just be another case of laws that would have the same problems as before. So whatever it is that underwrites the evolution of the laws, it has to have a quite different character than other physical laws. So perhaps there's a notion of singular causation that isn't bound by law-like regularities, or there are some other possibilities. But this seems actually to be, and Lee identifies it as such, a crucial question for defending the cogency of the evolving laws program, that there has to be some way of saying that it isn't just pushing the laws back one step. And finally, I want to say something briefly about how the question of evolving laws can fit into philosophical discussions of the accounts of laws. Let me just mention two of these briefly. Well, I'll just mention the one that's more well known. So David Lewis, Frank Ramsey, and others have defended what's nowadays called the best systems account of law. According to that conception, what a law is an axiom that maximizes the simplicity and strength of a deductive structure that captures all of a set of facts that's within a particular physical theory's domain. So you imagine then taking on the project of saying, well, what axioms will allow me to derive the most? So I want a sort of minimal set of axioms that allow me to sort of maximize this combination of strength and simplicity. Now, given the way this is usually characterized, you imagine that there's a way of describing the universe in terms of universal sets of occurrent facts, which are not themselves law-like, and then the laws are described as supervening on those. On that picture, if you just take that to truly be universal, then whatever laws you end up with as a result of this analysis will characterize everything. And you can only really end up with sort of non-universal laws and allow for the possibility of evolution if you restricted yourself to some smaller space-time region and said, let's characterize laws in that region, and then maybe you get a different answer if you chose different regions. But on this account, there's really no reason to make such a restriction. Now, again, this is perhaps would lead to a criticism of the best systems account of laws. If this is really a question of whether you think evolving laws should drive the accounts of philosophical accounts of laws of nature, whether you think the philosophical accounts of laws of nature are more stable and can be used to criticize the notion of evolving laws. There's another more recent paper, which I won't go into, but this is Mark Lang has an account of laws that he's used to argue that evolving laws are just not cogent, that they can't make sense given his account of laws. So let me then briefly wrap up. So I've tried to characterize a few of the main features of what I've been calling a Leibnizian cosmology. I looked at some of the early eliminativist arguments. I talked about the explanatory aims and discussed real-time and evolving laws as a way of meeting those explanatory aims. And I've considered these questions from a very different point of view, in which I've argued that it's not clear that the eliminativist arguments go through, that I don't think it's obvious that we should take these as elimination as opposed to reform of our conception of time, and so we don't end up with a timeless universe, even given conventional physics. I've defended a Newtonian approach to cosmology against the claim that it involves a cosmological fallacy, and I considered a few points about evolving laws, emphasizing that the notion of time that introduces a global time which allows this conception to have some content, rather than being connected directly to the real time of the manifest image. And I've said briefly a few things about the cogency of evolving laws. So thank you very much.
Questions? Lee Roberto, do you want to just want to make sure that you have a chance to respond before we...
A couple of things. Mm-hmm. Actually, I wrote down a bunch of things, but maybe we can discuss later. I'll mm-hmm. mention a couple of them. The point that Carlo Rovelli has made, the success of cosmology to this day, which you mentioned, which there are great successes, mm-hmm. Can be understood as still the discussion of a subsystem of the universe, that is, the homogeneous degrees of freedom, or homogeneous degrees of freedom plus the degree of freedom on the scale of freedom. Mm-hmm. So there's no doubt that there are standard empirical successes for standard cosmology, and Carlo's suggestion, which I think I endorse, is that we just put those in the category of descriptions of subsystems. Mm.
Yeah, so I guess there's a question that is maybe the more pressing one about the fallacy, which is, do you think it's the case in general relativity that there's an inherent problem with describing the whole universe that... Do you think that general relativity can't be taken as describing, is it always taken as describing subsystems?
I think there are inherent problems when you go to the cosmological case and try to discuss observables, try to discuss. These are other issues.
Right, these are issues from the point of view of quantum gravity.
But also classical relativity. So those are more technical issues. But
right, no, I'm aware of those. I'm not. And you think that those. So you think those are associated with the fallacy that you've argued for here?
Related to, yes. Yeah. There'll be more discussion of that in the book with Roberto.
Okay.
And rather than, like I said, I'll deal with discussing this. I have a whole list of things for you, but we can do that separately.
Okay.
Other questions? I'll take somebody else for a second.
I'm just curious because you said that you had like sort of more empiricist tendencies than mm-hmm. rationalist tendencies, but then
right.
I felt that everything you said was rationalist. So I would like to push you a little bit on that, but mm-hmm. it seems that your arguments against evolving laws are mostly on a rationalist basis, like whether conceivability, like whether like the Bondi mm-hmm. quote of like whether it would undermine our
right.
ability to reason and.
Right.
And your other point about why not assume that it's an accessibility problem, that if mm-hmm. you just get better and better equipment or whatever, we will eventually get there, right? That mm-hmm. it, like reminds me of this sort of passage in the philosopher Henri Bergson, right, mm-hmm. that writes about the spatialization of time and mm-hmm. how, if the world really is a curve, right, we can approach it with smaller and smaller tangents that are mm-hmm. straight lines, right, but that will still not make the world a straight line, right?
Okay.
And the question is here whether that is exactly what's at stake, like a tension between our assumptions that there is this straight line, rational mathematical feature of the universe, which is in empirical tension with our experience of time.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot there, so I don't know the Bergson well enough to comment. Let me characterize what I meant by rationalist as opposed to empiricist. So I think of the Newtonian approach to understanding the solar system. There, I think there is a certain framework that's adopted, but what does it allow you to do? It allows you to ask questions about the causes of motion of solar system bodies, which then you can look to nature for answers, in effect. It doesn't mean, so the idea of having a complete description of the exact curves traced by the planets is only kind of a regulative ideal in the limit of inquiry you might be approaching that. All you're doing in the meantime is sort of able to say, well, if I have a deviation from motion of a particular type, I can try to assess what the force is that would cause that kind of deviation. And so the empiricist is going to focus on the framework of ideas is allowing you to ask questions that then you'll have the empirical means to answer. Now, there's the reason why I'm saying I don't have the kind of rationalist tendencies is that you can ask further questions about maybe the very framework that's underwriting that line of reasoning. Why is it that these laws are the ones that you use to frame this project or this inquiry? Now, I don't know that, so at some level, you might be able to ask that question from the point of view of a further theory. You can ask why Newton's laws are a good approximation in certain contexts. But without that vantage point of a further theory, it's not clear to me what that question, why these laws, is really pushing, other than, and there's one way of answering it, which is, hey, they were, in effect, implicit in our dynamical reasoning. We've made them explicit in a way that allows us to carry out this this way of trying to understand the dynamics of solar system bodies much more carefully and quantitatively. But beyond that, what is it that you're asking? And so a rationalist would say, well, no, there's all kinds of questions about why these laws are the ones that obtain, that you can pose without having the vantage point of another theory to take it as a limiting case or anything like that. And so that's the kind of why these laws questions that I think, from an empiricist point of view, and I said I don't want to be quietistic. I mean, there's always a possibility of discovering those further theories that will allow you to understand the laws in a deeper way. But given a sort of domain in which you've been able to use the laws to reason successfully, it's not clear that you should always be pushing that as a part of the agenda of the science.
Let me take somebody in the back and we'll quickly go around. Let's try to be quick.
Mm-hmm. I was struck by your phrase, the inaccessibility of physics in the early universe.
Right.
And that's striking. And in conjunction with what we heard earlier, which I interpreted as a rejection of the singularity, mm-hmm. and with the first cosmological analysis, I'm wondering mm-hmm. if, in the end, we must conclude that beyond the historical aspect of cosmology, we end up with cosmology basically being speculative philosophy.
Well, so I entirely agree that saying that there's a singularity is something that's relative to a particular theory. And I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, well, look, given assumptions about what further theory might follow general relativity, you might think that there's a continuation through what in classical general relativity would be a singularity. I was thinking actually not of the singularity, but even just lower energy scales. Yeah. So think of it as take a time like baryogenesis, right? I think there are still a lot of open questions about how baryogenesis occurred. Why, there's a very appealing project of explaining antimatter-matter asymmetry by saying that there's a stage of evolution in the early universe that would have eliminated any earlier asymmetries. But the physics that's involved in that is, unlike the physics that you can use to describe Big Bang nucleosynthesis, not the sort of thing we have experimental probes of.
Right.
And so you're in a situation where you have theories about the relationships among fundamental quantities of interactions at a certain energy scale, which you're trying to understand, along with trying to understand how they came into play in a particular stage of historical evolution. And that's what I think is really challenging about early universe cosmology because of the interplay between those two. And it just gets worse as you go further back.
Very so great.
The point I'm trying to get at is that this inaccessibility makes it all untestable and therefore unscientific, and we fall back, I shouldn't use that term back, but we fall into a mode of speculative philosophy.
Oh, I think, and this is one way in which I agree with a lot of what Lee and Roberto are saying, there is a way in which early universe cosmology has become incredibly speculative when you get to questions about these, energy scales that are very close to the initial singularity. And that might just be something that we'll never be able to get around. And so this goes back to John's comment earlier, that maybe we should just have a modesty about what we can achieve in cosmology. Maybe we never will have the same degree of evidence for the theories at that scale that we do for theories at lower energy scales.
Right, but to just add this, we don't even have to look back then. We could look at today. Mm-hmm. So, for example, two things. We do know that there's something called dark energy, which is just a placeholder, really.
Right.
We know it's energy, right? I mean, it's just a placeholder.
We know that we don't.
With respect to, with respect to the data, when we look at how the data is analyzed, it's just a placeholder. That's the first thing. But to connect to something that you said that I really agree with, how we connect subsystems to the whole, in general relativity, the place where you even see that at low energy scales is the cosmological constant problem. Mm-hmm. We add up, you know, quantum fields locally,
right,
and we just stash it on to general relativity, and there's all this intermediate stuff that we just don't know how to account for.
Right.
So the problem occurs today. We don't have to go back to the Big Bang. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, we can talk about that later on. But.
John, can I ask you to ask the most important question of your 12 questions?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, cool. And the comment, tough question. First of all, we talked about non-time intervals. I think we should emphasize here, it hasn't been emphasized up now. You don't have a mathematical unit until you have a mathematical interval until you have a unit.
Mm-hmm.
Physical quantity different from mathematical quantities, they always have units. Every science,
right,
mathematics
right.
only enters once you have units, and that's what saves you from Platonism in one way. Secondly, we talked about Minkowski space-time and the past, at a point in time, past, future, and elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
That's because Minkowski space-time is time-orientable,
mm-hmm.
and then you have time-oriented, means you eliminate the time reversal transformation.
Right, right.
So that there are also manifolds that are not even time-oriented, so that's impossible.
Right.
But if you do deal with Minkowski space, it's the only thing that's invariant, you know, from the CPT theorem. If you want to allow time reversals, you have only the product of the charge conjugation, the spatial reflection, and
right.
the time reversal is invariant.
Right.
So there's a lot of interesting things there. Thirdly, by general relativity, I want to emphasize one of the features I haven't been mentioned. It's a hyperbolic system of partial differential equations.
Mm-hmm.
And a neat feature about a hyperbolic system of partial differential equations, it has real characteristic hyperservices
mm-hmm.
on which discontinuities can occur. And that is how information is conveyed in a hyperbolic system.
Mm-hmm.
A elliptic system cannot convey any information. If you know a little bit, you know everything. That's
mm-hmm.
analytic geometry, analytic functions. So it's very important to emphasize that general relativity being a hyperbolic system allows mm-hmm. one to have new information fed in on the characters of hyperservices.
Right.
The final point is about the global time. At least classically, it's an unobservable thing.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to do that, why not go back to Lorentz and Poincaré and say there really is an ether. And you know there is a real Lorentz contraction when you move through the ether, and a real the clocks really do slow down as you move through the ether. So you might say, well, Occam's razor says you can't distinguish the two, so eliminate it. Well, Unger and Smolin are saying, well, maybe we will ultimately observe this golden time.
Mm-hmm.
Just the same as Lorentz said, well, maybe we will ultimately observe the ether. And if you did ultimately observe the ether, special relativity would go down the drain. And I would say if you observe that global time, general relativity would go down the drain.
Yeah, I was arguing that the you could see the motivation for this is if you had a successful account of evolving laws that you had good evidence for and it had to have this global time parameter, then yes, you would introduce it. But I think it's a little bit more delicate because as I understood from, this is mainly from Lee's description of shape dynamics, is that it's meant to be a reformulation of general relativity that's not, you say it's a dual transformation. I don't know if you mean that that's a distinctive theory or how it stands with relation to just normal classical general relativity. So whether it would be a different theory or not is, I think...
It is largely the same theory formulated differently, but not completely.
Yeah.
Not every space-time is constantly curvaceous.
Yeah, no, that, I figured that would be a restriction.
If you were to observe that global time, that would violate the principle of general relativity.
Yes.
The same as if you observe the ether, it would violate special relativity.
Yes.
All right, well, let's thank all the speakers. Thank you all very much. Lee Smolin's book is here, if you're not aware of it, Time Reborn, I highly recommend it. And thank you all for coming. Again, there are posters with the rest of the Boston Colloquia out on the table in the hallway. Feel free to take one, sign up for email notices if you want one. And the next Boston Colloquium, again, will be with joint meeting with the History of Science Society on the public engagement of science, science in the streets. Thank you all for coming. Thank you.
you that back to you before I lose it.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah,
exactly. So I think I'll probably call everyone individually, but we'll go to dinner. I said we don't have any room anymore left in the hotel.
No, no.
So we've got about a half hour before we have to go. I'll probably be back in about 15 minutes or so. I'll just let you guys mingle while I sort of shuffle some things. Then we'll all go over to the restaurant.
Yeah, I should walk past 7 o'clock on the way over.
Okay, good. So you know where it is.